KPCW News, time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Let's find out what we got in store for our weather this weekend. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes with ABC4 Weather Center.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for this Friday for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at lots of sunshine expected today across the area. Temperatures are really going to start to warm up. We're talking highs climbing into the lower 80s for us in Park City for this afternoon. As we look at your Friday afternoon in the Heber Valley, look for those high temperatures to climb into the mid to upper 80s out there. So quite warm as we go throughout your Friday afternoon. As we go into the weekend, Saturday we'll kick things off with temperatures in the 40s in the Heber Valley. Will be in the low 50s in Park City, but we're going to really warm things up. We're talking highs in the mid 80s for us in Park City as we go throughout our Saturday afternoon. High temperatures will be climbing around 90 in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Sunday, look for lots of sunshine, temperatures kicking off the day in the low 50s, but get ready. Warm temperatures expected once again with highs back into the low to mid 80s in Park City with highs right around 90 once again in the Heber Valley. We'll start to see a few clouds on the increase as we get towards your Sunday night, and that'll set the stage for some changes as we go into the beginning of next week. Our Monday, looking at a good chance of scattered showers and storms, and that's going to also come along with some cooler air. Temperatures will start off in the 50s. As we go throughout your Monday afternoon, high temperatures will only be in the mid-60s in Park City and will be in the mid-70s for highs in the Heber Valley. So a big drop in temperatures there with a good chance of scattered showers and storms moving in. As we go into your Tuesday, we'll keep things unsettled with a chance of scattered showers and storms around across the area. Temperatures will kick off Tuesday in the mid-40s with highs only in the low-60s in Park City on Tuesday afternoon with highs only around 70 in the Heber Valley. We'll stick with the 60s for highs as we go into your Wednesday in Park City with partly cloudy skies. Partly cloudy skies back to the low 70s for the Heber Valley as we go into your Wednesday, but that sunshine returns in full force by next Thursday. Temperatures kicking off in the 40s with highs in the low 70s in Park City and highs back near 80 in the Heber Valley. From the ABC Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with Professor Scott Ballinger of the UVA Law School about the recently filed litigation by NPR. Then Janet Graham-Borba, Executive Vice President of HBO in charge of production, will join us to talk about the new HBO film shot here in Park City, Mountainhead. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Kate McChesney's about this year's Park Silly Mountain. Stay tuned. And that's Park Silly Market, not Park Silly Mountain. Maybe I'll get it straight sometime. Mountain Trails Foundation resource manager and prospector resident Ian Hartley is running for Park City Council. KPCW's Parker Malatesta talked to him about his campaign.
Hartley grew up in Toronto and moved to Park City in 2005 to work at Deer Valley Resort. An avid mountain biker, he stayed after falling in love with the community and a lifestyle that provides easy access to an abundance of trails. He later met his partner, Emma Gerard, and became a U.S. citizen in 2010. Before joining Mountain Trails Foundation in 2021, Hartley spent a decade working in local ski and bike shops, including White Pine Touring. He said he's running for office because he wants to contribute and guide the community into the future.
You know, and I think the changes are our biggest struggle. We're ramping up to host the world for the Olympic Games. We are struggling with a housing crisis. We are struggling with traffic. And I've worked as a manager at a local business before, and I know how hard that is for employees.
To solve local problems, Hartley said there are scalable solutions that are practical and easy to implement, utilizing the talents of various city departments. He said his family was fortunate to purchase a foreclosed home in 2012 and knows service workers, friends, and colleagues who continue to struggle to find housing in town. Hartley also said his experience with public transportation growing up in Toronto make him an asset in solving transportation issues.
I know there's going to be some growing pains. There always are. But, you know, we're all in this together at the end of the day. And I just really want to do my part and help move us to where we need to be to tackle those challenges that face us in the future.
Hartley said his work at Mountain Trails Foundation has led to nearly $1 million in grant funding and involves collaborating with property owners and various local and state agencies. He is also on the Summit County RAP Recreation Tax Grant Advisory Board and the McPullen Barnes Friends of the Farm Committee.
You know, I want Park City to be a better place for my boys as they grow up here. and for my family. And I also want it to be a place for generations to come to leave it loved, so to speak, and to contribute to a better community.
Hartley is the fourth person to announce a candidacy for the two open seats on the Park City Council. The other candidates who have declared so far are incumbents Tana Tolley and Jeremy Rubel, and Park City Community Foundation Vice President of Impact Diego Zagara. If five or more candidates file to run, a primary election August 12th will cut the candidate list to four ahead of the November 4th municipal election. Park City candidates must file between June 2nd to June 6th to be on the ballot. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And just this morning, KPCW learned that Molly Miller is planning to run for the Park City Council. The owner of Miller Media, she's been involved with the Park City Education Foundation and the parent-teacher organization at McPolin Elementary. She currently serves on the city's Nonprofit Services Advisory Board. We'll be doing a more complete story on Miller's announcement later today. If all of the candidates who have announced their candidacy in fact file, there will definitely be a primary this year for the Park City Council. This week, NPR sued the Trump administration seeking to invalidate an executive order cutting off all funds to NPR and PBS. Here to talk about the litigation is UVA law professor Scott Ballinger. Just a reminder that while KPCW is an NPR member station, the opinions expressed by Professor Ballinger are his and not necessarily those of KPCW. Morning, Scott.
Good morning, Roger.
Thanks for joining us. Can you set the stage a little bit by reminding our listeners of the relationship between the various entities, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, NPR, and PBS?
Sure. So the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was established by statute in 1967 to distribute public funds in support of public radio and television stations and programming. The corporation's boards are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but the statutes say that it is nonetheless a private nonprofit organization, not a federal agency. The corporation distributes about $500 million a year in funding, most of which goes to individual local public radio and TV stations like this one. NPR itself is a separate private nonprofit. It doesn't run radio stations. It produces and distributes content. So local public radio stations can, if they choose, become NPR member stations. They pay fees to NPR, and in return, they get NPR-produced content, like All Things Considered and other NPR shows. NPR also gets some money directly from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and other government grants, in addition, of course, to private philanthropy. And PBS is similar to NPR, but for public television rather than radio.
Okay, so what did the May executive order do, and how was it justified?
So on May 1st, the president issued an executive order entitled Ending Taxpayer Subsidization of Biased Media. It declares that NPR and PBS do not, quote, present a fair, accurate, or unbiased portrayal of current events to taxpaying citizens, end quote. And it basically directs the board members of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to cut off all direct and indirect financial support for NPR and PBS. Basically, the corporation is supposed to cancel all of its direct grants to NPR and tell the local radio and television stations that are funded by the corporation that if they want to continue getting any continuing money from the corporation themselves, they can't buy content from NPR and PBS.
Okay, so before we get to the lawsuit that was filed, I wanted to just touch on who they hired to represent them and why it is significant.
Well, like a lot of sophisticated litigants suing the Trump administration these days, they hired a conservative legal superstar to do it. They hired Miguel Estrada from the Gibson Dunn firm. Miguel is one of the smartest people you will ever meet and has kind of a famous story in legal circles. He immigrated to the United States from Honduras with his mother when he was 17 years old and at that point spoke hardly any English. And somehow just a few years later, he graduated magna cum laude from Columbia and from Harvard Law School and clerk for Justice Kennedy. He's argued two dozen cases in the Supreme Court. President Bush tried to appoint him to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. He was widely viewed at that time as a potential Supreme Court justice. Senate Democrats filibustered his nomination to the D.C. Circuit, and that was the event that really set off the current 20-year partisan war over judicial confirmation to the lower courts. Miguel is very highly regarded and very conservative. So just like some of the law firms who were the subject of these Trump executive orders have hired Paul Clement, hiring Miguel Estrada, I think, is NPR's way of saying that all of this is not about politics, it's about principle.
He is one of the smartest people I've ever met. Scott, there are both statutory and constitutional claims presented. Let's start with the statutory claims. And once again, the lawsuit was brought by NPR, and there is a member station that is also included as a plaintiff. So let's review. What are the statutory claims?
So NPR's core claim is that the president just doesn't have the authority to do this, right? Congress created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and made it independent. It is not part of the federal government. And the Public Broadcasting Act actually says directly that no department, agency, officer, or employee of the United States can exercise any direction, supervision, or control over the corporation or its grantees and contractors. So the basic design of the Public Broadcasting Act is that the president gets to appoint the corporation's board with the advice and consent of the Senate, but doesn't get to tell them what to do. And there's a strong argument that Congress insulated the corporation from political pressure like this for a reason. So NPR has the usual argument that's been made against a lot of Trump administration initiatives lately, that they just don't have authority to decree all of these things by executive fiat. If they want to fundamentally change how the Corporation for Public Broadcasting works, they should go through Congress and pass legislation. But here that argument is even sharper than usual, because the statutes Congress passed actually seem to directly forbid political interference with the corporation.
And now, do the recent Supreme Court case involving independent agencies, does that have any potential impact on that statutory argument? Because the language seems pretty strong and pretty compelling.
Yeah, it does. So the Trump administration's counterargument, I suspect, will be, or at least will include, that any statute that tells the president he can't tell the corporation board what to do is just unconstitutional. As you referenced, the court recently ruled in a case called Trump versus Wilcox that the president can fire members of the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board, despite statutes saying very clearly otherwise. And this is a sort of unitary executive argument that, you know, the president really has to be in charge of the executive branch. In Trump versus Wilcox, the majority of the court said that this doesn't necessarily mean that the president can fire members of the Federal Reserve, and said that the Federal Reserve is a uniquely structured quasi-private entity that follows in the distinct historical tradition of the first and second banks of the United States, end quote. Who knows what that means for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? But the point is that this dispute over the statutory independence of the corporation is just one front in a much larger war about independent agencies more broadly. And the Trump administration will surely argue that the president has the power to control the corporation.
Okay, the First Amendment claims are those that have gotten the most attention. Why isn't this just a simple case of unlawful viewpoint discrimination?
Well, NPR to some extent wants to cast this as a simple violation of the viewpoint discrimination principle that the government just can't punish you because it doesn't like what you say, right? And that's clearly true as far as it goes. If the government said, we're going to take away your driver's license because you said something critical about the president, that's a very cut and dried violation of the First Amendment. The government can't retaliate against people for exercising their right to free speech. But I think this isn't quite that simple, because the executive order isn't punishing NPR exactly. It's just threatening to take away a whole bunch of the government's own money. And I think everyone agrees the government doesn't have any obligation to subsidize public broadcasting. And they would say NPR is free to continue speaking however it wants, just on its own dime. So what's wrong with that?
And isn't the response to that, well, look, once you decide to give money for a broadcasting exercise, you can't then turn around and say, yes, but only if you broadcast certain opinions? So, I mean, you know, I hear you that it might make sense to say they could withdraw the funding altogether. But can they put content-related strings on money that overtly is designed to create a broadcasting system?
Yeah, so I think there's three potential analogies here in the current case law. And which one you find most persuasive probably determines what you think about this. So one is that when the government appropriates money for a public program, it gets some latitude to define the limits and the scope of that program. So, for example, there was a famous case in the 1990s called Rust versus Sullivan, where Congress made it a condition of federal family planning funds for doctors that the doctors delivering those family planning counseling services couldn't talk about abortion. The doctors sued and argued that that violated their First Amendment right to talk to their own patients however they chose. And the Supreme Court said, no, when Congress establishes a funded program, it gets to define the scope and limits of that program. So if the government wants to fund a contraception awareness program that doesn't talk about abortion, that's fine. You can, as a doctor, talk about abortion. Just do it on your own time and your own nickel. The government will say that this NPR dispute is kind of like that. Mm. On the other hand, there's a line of cases that lawyers call public forum doctrine, which more or less hold that when the government creates a forum for private speech, it can't discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. So if your local elementary school, for example, opens up its classrooms on Saturdays for community groups to use in a broad-based kind of way, it has to be viewpoint neutral. It can't say, well, we'll allow the Rotary Club to use these classrooms, but not a church group, for example. NPR will say this is kind of like that. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting wasn't created to disseminate a government message like the family planning program in Russ versus Sullivan. It was created to foster a wide variety of completely private expression. And there's a lot of evidence for that. On the other hand, there's the name, right? The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the fact that the corporation is clearly pursuing important public purposes. So it's hard. I want to throw one more analogy at you, if you'll indulge it, which is the National Endowment for the Arts. The NEA exists to subsidize arts organizations and artists, and the governing statute that says the NEA should fund art that is excellent and consistent with decency and respect for the values of the American people was challenged by a group of artists back in the 1990s who argued that those criteria for grants were viewpoint discriminatory, that maybe they wanted to make indecent art or art that challenges the values of the American people, right? And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't just transplant viewpoint discrimination precedents that might make sense in other contexts into the unique context of arts funding. When the government acts as an arts patron, it is entitled to insist on excellence and respect for American values. I would expect the Trump administration to argue in this case that similarly, when the government acts as a patron for public radio and television, it is entitled to insist on journalistic balance and nonpartisanship, and that doing so isn't the same thing as viewpoint discrimination.
You know, it's interesting. We can say something like journalistic balance, but at the end of the day, there's a longstanding sort of thread in First Amendment jurisprudence that says one of the most core values of the First Amendment is political expression. And in that sense, it's different than pornography, for example, and other kinds of things. And I guess it's really hard for me to grasp how a governmental entity can come in and say, well, you need to be more fair, and not have that concept of fairness be intrinsically a political judgment, which the First Amendment would preclude them from doing.
I think that's exactly right. I think this is very difficult because on the one hand, the public purposes that make it make sense for the public to fund broadcasting at all sort of require fair, unbiased, and nonpartisan content, right? I mean, the private market is perfectly good at delivering to us lots of misleading, biased, and partisan media content. We don't need public funding for that, right? So if it were really true that NPR and PBS, were not providing unbiased and fair content, then I think a lot of the American people would say, well, that's a really good reason not to provide public money. On the other hand, I think you're exactly right that the exercise of deciding as political actors what is biased or partisan and what isn't, inherently involves the government in the sort of judgments that the First Amendment usually precludes. And for that reason, I think this is going to be a very difficult case.
Okay, so who's the case pending before?
So it's in front of the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia. Judge Randy Moss has been assigned to the case. He is also hearing a related case brought by three board members of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting who were fired by the president earlier this year. In that sense, it sort of makes sense for him to get this case. He's a good judge. He's not afraid to rule against the government. He's ruled against the Trump administration before. So in that sense, maybe NPR might like this draw.
And did they? I haven't seen yet any indication that they're seeking any preliminary injunctive relief. If they don't do that, how long is this case likely to take?
Well, I checked this morning, and they still haven't filed for an injunction, although the case was only filed on Tuesday or Wednesday, I guess, so this is very early in the process. They may still. If they don't ask for an injunction, you know, the D.C. District Court is dealing with an awful lot of important challenges to Trump administration processes, and if they are not requesting injunctive relief, I would expect this to move, you know, pretty slowly. It certainly wouldn't be resolved this year.
And is this the kind of case that could ultimately end up in front of the Supreme Court?
You know, it's really an interesting question. In ordinary times, I would say absolutely yes. This is the sort of case that's likely to go to the Supreme Court. But these are not ordinary times, right? I mean, there is a long list of important institutions that have been defunded or dissolved recently by the administration or by DOGE acting on the administration's behalf in ways that are arguably unlawful and have been challenged in court. The Supreme Court can't possibly weigh in on all of them, right? I mean, so the U.S. Institute for Peace, USAID, there are a lot of these cases. And the Supreme Court is going to want to pick their battles, both, you know, out of limits on their own capacity, but also a desire, I would suspect, to try to produce as much agreement among their own ranks as they can. So I suspect it depends on what the lower courts do in the case. I mean, so for example, the lower courts have largely enjoined at this point the dismantling of USAID, and the Supreme Court has refused to intervene. If the lower courts enjoin the government from canceling all of NPR's funding, then the urgency is sort of off, and maybe the case can take a long and winding path. If they don't, then there will be more pressure. I think we'll see.
Scott Ballinger, I hope we can get you to come back and explain the decision once it's rendered.
Thank you, Roger. It's always nice to talk to you.
We'll be right back after this.
A new film that was largely shot here in Park City will premiere this weekend on HBO. Joining me to talk about the production is HBO Executive Vice President of Production, Janet Graham-Borba. Janet, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me, Roger.
So, Janet, can you tell us a bit about the new film that will be lighting up our screens this weekend?
Absolutely. So it's called Mountain Head. It was directed by Jesse Armstrong, who was our showrunner for many years on Succession, amongst other credits for sure. And it stars Steve Carell, Jason Schwartzman, Rami Youssef, and Corey Michael Smith. They play four billionaires having a weekend away in the mountains.
And it is set here in Park City. How much of it was sort of shot here in Park City?
Every bit of it.
Okay, and is it supposed to be?
Yeah.
Is it overtly in Park City? Do they sort of acknowledge the location?
It definitely acknowledges Utah. I'm trying to remember if there was actually a Park City reference, but definitely Utah is referred to.
And talk a little bit about the locations that you used here in town. What kinds of places did you go, or was it mostly shot at a single home?
It was mostly shot at a single home, which is, in our story, the home belonging to one of the billionaires who has invited this circle of friends who meet periodically to come for a weekend away. We did a couple of shots elsewhere, a private airfield, an industrial park, but almost everything across the 22 days of shooting, almost everything was in a single house.
And can you just share a little bit more about the plot without giving anything away?
Oh, okay. Probably not. there will be a little bit that's been in the press. You know, the guys are coming together at a time of a little bit of unrest and chaos, and they each are bringing a little bit of a personal struggle to the weekend and a lot of history between the four men. If you watched Succession, you'll have a sense of the flavor of Jesse Armstrong's approach to wit, intelligence, power, social consequence, but also just personal relationships between people over time. It's terrific. It's terrific. It's a really, really good film.
He has a really interesting perspective on very rich people, doesn't he?
He does. He does indeed.
Okay.
And because he is British, his observation of Americans in that category is particularly sharp. It's wonderful. really wonderful.
So tell us a little bit about how the film ends up being shot here. What is the process by which you identify a location like ours?
Great. So this is actually a really, really fun story if you do kind of what I do for a living. So normally a movie going very fast takes a couple of years from pitch to being out in the world. Someone has to pitch it. Someone has to agree to finance it. Then it needs to be written and rewritten. And then it needs to be cast and then prepped and then shot and then posted. In this case, Jesse Armstrong sat down at a breakfast in December of 2024, so 5 months ago, with Casey Boyes, who heads up programming for HBO and for HBO Max, and pitched this idea. And Casey loved it and said, absolutely, but two conditions. One was how much we could spend, and the second was that he wanted it on the air by the end of May. Jesse sort of scratched his head and said, well, it's a pretty contained idea and it's pretty fully formed in my head. I think I can do that. So it was written, pitched in December, written in January, scouted and prepped in February, shot in March, posted in April, and we had a premiere event at MoMA here in New York this past Thursday. It'll be on the air on Saturday. So kind of an warp speed. And there was no script, so normally a location manager, a producer, a production designer will read the script very, very carefully, and it all comes from script. Where does the story want to be told? So in this case, we needed a new home of a very wealthy person in the mountains of the North American West. So we didn't have any time, so we pulled location photos, and by we, I mean our location manager, pulled photos in Colorado, in Utah, in, I'm not sure if he pulled any from Wyoming, but also from British Columbia, and looked at lots of different houses that might work for the telling of the story. And then you do the math problem of how expensive is it to film here versus here versus here versus here, and does the story work creatively as well here as there, and those two things get weighed against one another. And then we scouted only two places. One was the Park City area, and the other was near Whistler in British Columbia, which for lots of reasons, exchange rate, crew costs, et cetera, would have been a less expensive choice, but didn't offer the same house that Jesse had fallen in love with for the story that you will see in the film. And the same kind of, this isn't quite the right word, but isolation or privacy that makes the story really, really work. That you believe these four men are alone. You know, there's no one peeking over the fence or watching cars drive by. And that's a bit of a part of the tone of the piece, I think. But there was also a lot about this particular house to recommend it. When you see it, it has a lot of bells and whistles that feel both very contemporary and definitely sort of have that smell of wealth. So anyway, the house is beautiful. And then we got all this amazing support from the Utah Film Commission and from the Park City Film Office, from the neighbors and the property manager of the house Jesse had fallen in love with, and the neighbors of that house. We were able to use to also rent the house up the mountain from it, which gave us a place to, you know, to sort of stage things a little bit and to have people have another place to be and not be in the middle of our set all day. And that made it super helpful too. And we had a really extraordinary surprise, which is that there are a ton of filmmakers local to Park City. So we had feared shooting something up in the mountains, we'd have to bring everyone in and put everyone in hotels, and that just takes your budget off the screen. And that just proved not to be true. We had a tremendous amount of people that we were able to hire locally who have, you know, spectacular credits and work at a very high level. And that was a kind of a wonderful surprise.
So mechanically, as I'm listening to this story, I'm trying to understand the interactions between HBO, your organization on the one hand, and producers and showrunners on the other. The ideas, the burden of figuring out locations and identifying them and figuring out the budget, does that fall under your rubric, or is that an interactive thing between you and a producer or a showrunner?
We definitely, particularly at HBO, all things are driven by the creative. That's what we're there in service of. What is the story that Jesse wants to tell? And if he can do it within the resources that we have for him, how do we support him doing it his way? Because you live or die by someone's vision on your show. And in this case, it was Jesse's. This was also going to be the first time Jesse directed. He is a profoundly capable showrunner, but this was his first time being a director. And so that was kind of exciting for everyone too. Did I answer your question?
Did.
I'm not sure I answered it. Yeah.
You did. So you sort of rent these two homes. Talk a little bit about what has to happen to a home when it's being used as a set.
Ah, okay. In this case, the bones of the house were perfect and there was no time to change bones anyway. There's a tremendous amount of glass in the house, as you can imagine, from a mountain contemporary home. And that's a little bit tricky to film in because not only might you see something out the window, like there's not as much night today as there was yesterday or something, but you also get reflections back of lights and cameras and crew members and things like that. So you have to shoot pretty carefully in the house and you have to light it pretty carefully to minimize that. You also have, we have this spectacular production designer named Stephen Carter. He was the production designer on Succession as well. And so he came in and there were things he wanted to change out to make a character point or, you know, change the way a room might be filmed. So you come in and you protect everything at a location like that. There may be things that have to be boxed up and put away. Floors have to be protected. You may have to paint some walls and then you have an agreement with the owner that you'll paint them back or leave them repainted as the owner wishes. And then you're very careful about L&D, loss and damage. Very, very careful about that with the crew. We had about 160 people on the crew. They certainly weren't all in the house at the same time all the time, but coming and going, grip, electric, camera, hair and makeup, the gamut of folks, art department people, props people. And we had sort of a unique visual effects department on this one because we had so little time in post-production. There's visual effects in everything that you see anymore. You use it to fix things, you use it to make things seamless. But in this case, we didn't have time to do much, if anything. So the entire responsibility of our visual effects supervisor and producer was to be there every minute of every day and tell them what they needed to do in order to not have a visual effect. So this is, you know, if you'll screen the light just this little bit, you won't get a reflection on that window and I won't have to clean that up. We did do a fair amount of snow work in visual effects. Shooting across 4.5 weeks, obviously the ground doesn't look the same every single day, and our story is taking place across a very short weekend, so it needed to all look like it was continuous.
How long does it take to put a house back together after you do something like that?
You always allow for, depending on the needs of the owner, for, you know, a couple of weeks. You need everybody to get everything film-related out, and that takes a day or two. And then you need to walk through it and fix, you know, the crew needs to walk through it, the locations team walks through it and fixes absolutely everything that they can see that needs fixing. They put everything back, they check everything. But then you have to do walkthroughs with the property manager and the owner if they want to be there and double check everything and then fix again if something isn't quite right. So it's pretty iterative, but also something that people take a lot of pride in doing very, very well. You know, a location manager is sort of by personality usually. They're very sensitive to the impact of filming on a place and on the people who need to use that place as something other than a film set. So they take a lot of care.
So,
and this was a...
I'm sorry. I didn't...
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, no, not at all. I think I stepped on you. Our location manager was a guy called Paul Eskenazi, and he did a really, really nice job. So
this timeline that you've described of like 5 or 6 months total, which is just extraordinary. You've been doing this a while. I'm not going to ask you how long, but have you ever seen anything like this in terms of this kind of a timeline?
Never. And my boss keeps saying, well, now you're a victim of your own success. So I'm a little bit terrified about what's going to happen next time. No, this has not been done, not by us and not at this level by anyone that I'm aware of. So you can do lots of sort of little indie movies where you're going to shoot for 5 days. You can do those quickly. But, you know, a show written by someone of that prominence with that level of artistic care, with that caliber of cast, and the what I think you will be impressed by in terms of production value and storytelling, not this quickly. No.
We've been speaking with Janet Graham-Borba, the Executive Vice President of Production at HBO, about the new film Mountainhead, which premieres on HBO this weekend. Janet, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
You are so welcome. Thank you so much for talking to me. Enjoy the movie.
The Park City Film Series will hold a free screening of Mountainhead on June the 5th at 7 p.m., followed by a discussion with production supervisor Brooke Redman and Utah Film Commission production manager Derek Mellis. It'll be moderated by Utah Film Commission director Virginia Pierce. While the film is free, you do need to get tickets. You can get them online at parkcityfilm.org. Mediator, author, and Utah State University professor Chad Ford will be in Park City to share his research on navigating conflict in constructive ways. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Conflict can range from disagreements with spouses and coworkers to international issues between countries. USU professor Chad Ford says conflict isn't always negative.
It can actually be a really positive thing, but because we often lack the skills and we approach conflict with a lot of fear, it often feels like it is the worst thing that could possibly be happening to us. I try to focus on what is the conflict that is closest to you, because that's going to be the one that's going to be the easiest for you to be able to get your arms around.
Ford spent 20 years working to resolve conflict in the Middle East. He says there are no quick fixes between political leaders and that amends are made on what he calls the grassroots peace-building level.
It often starts close in. Who are my neighbors? Who are the people that are closest to me? If I don't feel like I can move the needle nationally, how do I move it locally? And I think that these are skills that people often don't think about when we start thinking about these larger scale conflicts. I'm so focused on the big conflict that I forget that there is a series of small conflicts between people that are often fueling the larger one.
The Mountain Mediation Center invited Ford to speak in Park City. He's titled his talk, The Courage to Listen, Turning Conflict into Collaboration.
We're going to spend some time thinking about our approaches to conflict, how we see conflict, how it affects our ability to navigate conflict effectively. We're going to practice some skills about how we reflect, how we take a pause, how we ask good questions, how we listen to understand, and how we start to incorporate what we're learning in our listening to be able to help us find a solution that not only works for them, but works for us as well.
Chad Ford will speak Sunday, June 1st at the Park City Eccles Theater at 6 p.m. Tickets are available at a link online at kpcw.org. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
Heber City will soon be home to more than 70 sculptures inspired by the country's founding and the Book of Mormon. KPCW's Grace Dorfler was at Thursday's groundbreaking.
On the dusty hillside above Utah Valley University's Wasatch campus, sculptor Stephen Neal whisked away two tarps to reveal George Washington and Jesus, each cast in bronze and bound for a one-of-a-kind garden Neal says came to him in a vision. The Monument of the Americas has been 30 years in the making, and on Thursday, about 100 people joined Neal in the next step toward making his vision a reality. Neal is many things, a sculptor, a painter, a retired plastic surgeon, a singer, but on Thursday, he was most of all a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He told the crowd through tears it took a long time to find a home for his sculptures.
How did I end up doing what I did? It's simple if you think of it in terms of a covenant. I made a promise to God, if he would bless my talents, I'd just keep at it. never knowing if this would happen.
Neil used a billboard truck to show a video of what the garden will look like one day. It will feature a waterfall cascading over a wall designed to look like the Golden Plates, from which LDS faithful believe Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon. And Neil says the garden's crown jewel will be an 18-foot statue of Jesus.
This will be lit up at night. You'll be able to see it from all parts of the valley.
Local and state leaders joined Neil in sharing testimonies of faith at Thursday's ceremony. Former Utah Governor Gary Herbert said the story of the United States founding can't be separated from the story of the LDS Church.
I believe these founding fathers were raised up by God for the LDS. We know that's part of LDS scripture, to have this country ordained by Heavenly Father.
And Heber City Council member Aaron Cheatwood said he hopes visitors to the sculpture garden will be inspired to live according to the virtues the church teaches.
The stories of the Book of Mormon teach us of love and peace, of patience and kindness, and of understanding. And because of that, I think they're specifically meant for us in our day, in our time.
Neil said Thursday the project already has $3 million in cash donations, plus the 12-acre site donated by the developer of the nearby Jordan L. Ridge project. The sculptor said he will commemorate top donors in various ways in the garden, like working their likenesses into statues. The park will open in phases. Neil previously told KPCW he expects all 71 sculptures will be finished by 2028. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Rocky Mountain Power is challenging a Utah Public Service Commission decision to grant a small portion of the utility company's proposed electricity rate hike. The power company argues that denying its ability to fully recover cost increases is short-sighted and threatens the long-term reliability, safety, and resiliency of the state's electric grid. Utah News Dispatch reports the Public Service Commission approved a 4.7% increase in residential rates in April. That was a quarter of the 18.1% bump the utility requested last August after revising its original 30.5% proposal. In a 130-page document filed this week, Rocky Mountain Power requested a rehearing, stating the order improperly denies the company recovery of prudently incurred expenses. Rocky Mountain Power wrote that the order compromises the utility's financial stability and its ability to add the necessary investment the state needs to continue its economic growth. Francis is doubling down on its approval of a new hotel in town. KPCW's Connor Thomas has its response to residents suing the city over the proposed Best Western.
While some Francis residents say the city code should not allow the Best Western on State Route 32, the city says the code speaks for itself. Francis wrote in a recent filing in 3rd District Court, the code's intent is to provide physical and visual protection between commercial and residential uses. It says the city council has done that. But the residents along Lambert Lane, just behind where the Best Western is to be built, appealed the approval to district court in April. They say Judge Richard Mrozek should block the hotel because city code requires it to be, quote, away from their homes. Francis's lawyers have said that bit of code is too vague to enforce. City attorneys doubled down May 27th, saying the city council was justified when it gave the Best Western a permit. Francis says in the filing, quoting its own code, where differing uses are to be developed adjacent to existing residential areas, special consideration shall be made to protect the privacy of residents. Francis did impose 14 additional conditions on the builder, Harwood Development, such as fencing to block headlights and trees to block noise. The residents who live in the village at Lambert Lane contend their concerns weren't adequately addressed. Concerns ranged from noise to light to crime during the marathon public hearings earlier this year. Mrozek says both parties should be ready for trial by August 2026. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, this Sunday, the Park Silly Market will be back for another year. Here with all the details is Kate McChesney. Morning, Kate.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining me. So, Kate, let's start with some history.
Thank you.
How long has the market been in existence and how has it evolved?
We are celebrating our 19th year.
You don't look that old.
A long time. I know, right? Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I think I was 15 when I started. So we're celebrating our 19th year. We started back in 2007, and way back then, these three amazing women of Park City with a bottle of wine and a napkin basically put this entire plan together. And back then, it was more like a flea market or just kind of a get-together on Sundays because there was really nothing ever to do on Sundays. A, in Park City, half of Main Street was shut down, if not more. And then really in Utah alone, there's not a whole lot to do on Sundays. And so they decided to shut down Lower Main Street, throw a party, live music. We even had a bar way back then. Our opening day, we had 35 vendors and just shy of 500 people. And here we are now 19 years later, and we have about 200 vendors on the street on any given Sunday. And last year we had an average of 16,000 people on the street on every given Sunday. So that's a big evolve.
Well, I was going to say, so the population of Park City essentially doubles on Sundays when we have a Park City market. It does feel that way, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so how many Sundays are you going to be open this year?
So we're going to be open 11 Sundays. So we're going to kick off this Sunday, and we're going to go 5 in June. We'll take off really kind of that July 4th weekend Sunday, and then we'll come back in July for the 13th and the 21st. Then we take a really nice break. We'll come back August 31st, and then 3 in September. So September, oh gosh, the 7, 15, 21, something of that effect.
So I didn't count. How many
Whatever
is that?
Whatever the Sundays are. 11.
11.
It's
Sundays.
11.
Okay.
11 Sundays, yeah.
Now, for those, we talked a little bit about the evolution. For people who have not sort of been, describe what they'll find if they walk on Lower Main Street on any given Sunday.
It's free.
That's
and
important.
I would say street festival is really the way to define us. And so you're going to have live music. You're going to have eclectic vendors. You're going to have tons of great people. We've got face painters, balloon artists, so things for the children. Lots of great food, hot food, gourmet food. Fresh flowers are coming. I know this coming Sunday the petunias are popping, so we're going to have our amazing petunia vendor coming. And so it's really just, I mean, it's going to be a beautiful weather.
Mm-hmm.
So just and a beautiful day to spend on Lower Main, and also to, you know, go and walk up, I should say Higher Main, go and walk up Upper Main and, you know, explore all of our beautiful galleries and restaurants and stores that are all open as well this coming Sunday.
And what are...
It's a kickoff to summer.
And is there anything new about this year's festival that people should be aware of?
I mean, really, it's just not necessarily new. The market will always feel the same because we have the same footprint. But really, I mean, a lot of the new vendors, we have 17 youth vendors joining us this summer, so we're excited for that. I think we have 20 kids in rotation doing busking along the street, so they'll start at the top of Main and kind of every couple of blocks, you know, you'll see another youth busker playing everything from the cello to the piano to the guitar, all of our local great Park City musicians that sign up for us every year. So really, I mean, it's a lot of new for us. Just doesn't feel that way until you really start looking at all the vendors and everything that we're bringing.
Can you share with people a little bit about, you know, how much live music there is and how do you guys book all that? I mean, it looks like a fairly daunting task to me.
Well, you know, there's certain things that we rely on our amazing partner, like Mountain Town Music. Mm. So Brian's team, he's been programming our main stage for goodness, I would say 13 years, maybe 14 years. And so we really leave it to him because that's what he does really, really well. And so he has an eclectic group that he brings to the stage. He does a really great rotation. So we typically start with two live bands on the main stage, and those will kick off around, you know, 12 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And then they'll go all the way till 4:45. And then as far as all the youth musicians, I put out a Google Doc to a bunch of youth musicians and including some of the schools here locally, and the kids just sign up. And so kind of takes the ball out from under me, which is great. And so that's kind of how all that's done.
So let's talk about getting there and parking and options.
Oh, yeah.
first of all, my favorite way to get there has traditionally been the bike check. Is that going to be there this year?
Absolutely.
Okay. Explain how that works.
Yeah, the bike check because bike, bus, or walk to the market, it's, you know, one of the things we really encourage. And so you can park over at the high school or you could park over at Richardson Flats and then just hop on your bike. When you get to the market, come in on Lower Main, come in off of 9th, and then you can traverse over or you can take the bike path from City Park, you know, and traverse up. And then up in our food alley, which is really where Loma is or the Indian restaurant, right up that alley there is our free bike valet, and it's a secure bike valet, which is great because, as you know, people in Park City, their bikes are worth sometimes more than their cars. And so we have this amazing free bike valet. We've got two kids every Sunday from the Park City High School that will monitor the bike valet to make sure all of your bikes are safe. They also have a bike pump and some tuning gear if you wanted to, you know, get a quick tune while you're there. So, yeah, and that's really what we encourage.
And other transit options, let's make sure we got them. You can park at the high school or at the transit center. There'll be regular bus service from both of those locations.
Correct, yeah. Buses will go anywhere between 10 and 15 minutes, and eventually they'll get you to the market. So depending on what bus you jump on, some have a direct right to transit, or they'll drop you right off on Park Avenue right underneath the bridge. And so it's really easy to come in and out of the market that way.
And remind our listeners what the hours will be this coming Sunday.
So we are 10 to 5, rain or shine, on the 11 select Sundays.
Okay. Anything else you want to share with our listeners? And is there a website where they can learn more?
They can learn more at our website, which is parksillysundaymarket.com. Our vendors, we are sold out for the summer with an extensive wait list. So if you do want to vend with us, get your application in early next year. We'll kick those off in December. But no, we're looking forward to another beautiful summer. And, you know, thank you to Park City and Main Street for allowing us a few more years.
All right. Kate McChesney with the Park Silly Market, back for another year. Kate, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Roger. Have a great day.